And then, like Pandora, opening the great big box of the world and not being afraid, not even caring whether what's inside is good or bad, because it's both. Everything is always both, but you have to open it to find that out.
You're entering a cosmic void. Welcome to A Cosmic Void. I'm Biggs.
I'm Jeremiah.
And today we're doing The Girl with All the Gifts. Jeremiah, when you suggested this movie to me, I had no idea what it was, and I did not know it was going to be a Glenn Close zombie movie.
Right.
I don't think I would have gotten that within 10,000 guesses.
Yeah, no. When I saw the picture for this movie, it has the main character, Melanie, with a face mask, like almost kind of like a Silence of the Lambs style. It's a picture of her and a bunch of army people in the background, and I was like, oh, this must be like some kind of war movie, like Tears of the Sun or like, you know, something like that. So I put it on to go to sleep, and I was genuinely shocked by Glenn Close. First of all, I was not expecting that at all, and then just this movie bangs from literally like the first 10 minutes. Like, it's right into the action, and I was fairly impressed by this movie, so much so that I wanted to, like, I keep wanting to do a fucking romance movie or something, or like something just out of the ordinary, but I keep hitting these movies where I'm like, fuck, we gotta cover this movie, man. It's just too good to not talk about. And I'm sure, like, not a lot of people are talking about this movie, and I want to kind of put it out there.
There is not much on the internet about this movie, so a couple of the categories are a little bit dry, but, you know, I can only do what I can do. But it's not like there's not stuff to talk about with this movie.
Yeah,
it is right in line with a lot of horror movies that are coming out nowadays where they have the social commentary built in. There's a couple of things going on in this movie, and it's pretty interesting. I've never heard of it. I never heard anybody talk about it. The first time I knew it was even a zombie movie was I mentioned that that was a movie I was going to watch, and Carl was like, oh, you're watching a zombie movie? I was like, am I? Like, I have no idea.
Right.
And then when I started watching it, I started to think maybe he was mistaken in the first couple of minutes. And then obviously things happen where it becomes obvious. But yeah, it's an interesting movie for sure.
I got very big 28 Days Later vibes. And if you've ever played the game The Last of Us, very on par with that. Because it's based on a book.
Yeah, it's based on a book that was written at the same time as the screenplay.
Oh, really? I did not know that. Okay, cool. Yeah, published in 2014. This is like definitely a 28 Days Later vibe mixed with The Last of Us, which if you've ever played The Last of Us, a zombie game, but the twist is that the zombies are infected by fungi. Which I thought was a very interesting, because they definitely took that from that. Actually, let me look it up.
We didn't hit the spoiler zone yet.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my bad.
That's all good. I don't care. It's a video game.
Yep.
If you hadn't heard all that talk, like, I've never played that game. I've heard people talk about it endlessly since the second one came out. So I feel like everybody knows who's going to play it at this point.
One of the best zombie games ever made, in my opinion, just because it does what The Walking Dead did with the graphic novel series, where it's a zombie series that's not really about zombies. It's a part of the environment, but there's more to the story than just, let's hold up in a fucking mall with shotguns.
So it's interesting you say let's hole up in a mall with shotguns, because the original Dawn of the Dead, George A. Romero, that is about consumerism.
Right.
It's just when Zack Snyder remakes it, it becomes just a movie about zombies, right?
Yeah, right.
I mean, honestly, if you watch the original one, like, all of Romero's movies have social commentary running through them. It was definitely a thing that he did from the 60s up until he died. But it's just horror kind of went away from that for a while, particularly in the 80s when you have your Jasons and Freddies and Michael Myers. They just start to ignore it. And the first Halloween actually does have social commentary. It's a lot about a lot of evilness that's going on in the suburbs. But as you go on into the 80s and you have Coca-Cola buying out Columbia and things like that, they're like, just give us the thing that's going to make a lot of money. We don't care about the message behind it. Just give us the thing that makes money. And you start to get directors that are more focused on making commercial movies. And so your horror movies, while there's some that are scary that come out then, they're fucking vapid when you start to pull them apart and start to look at what they're trying to say. They're not trying to say anything. They're just trying to scare you. Like,
right.
I Know What You Did Last Summer. What the fuck is that movie saying? You know what I mean?
And I don't want to shit on those movies.
Oh, I do. That's why I said it.
Honestly, because I do like the Zack Snyder Dawn of the Dead. I do. It's just like, as an adult, that's not really what I'm looking for anymore. When I was younger, yeah. It's like, yeah, absolutely. Zombies, good sex scene, crazy fucking horribleness going on. Dope. I want all of that. But now I feel like I want these stories that have more depth to them.
I'm not going to let you go for misspeaking earlier, because when you compared it to 28 Days Later, and then you said it's not like people running around in the mall, you know, with shotguns. Yeah. It also occurred to me that 28 Days Later, guess who produced that?
Zack Snyder?
George Romero.
No way. Really?
Yeah.
That's so actually, you compared really
a Romero produced movie directed by Danny Boyle, but
yeah.
Romero produced it. Like, you compared that to a remake of one of his movies, which I just think is hilarious.
That's so funny. And I mean, I do like the old Romero movies, but you know, I'm definitely from a generation that saw 28 Days Later. And I would say that's like, what is your trilogy? You know, what is your trilogy, right?
Like movies in general? Are you talking horror, or are you just talking in general?
I meant in the text of, like, you know, some people are like, well, Star Wars was my trilogy series that, like, defined my life. I grew up in the time where 28 Days Later was like, that was my zombie movie, you know?
Yeah, I understand that. I was in my early 20s when that came out, I think. So it's not like I was divorced from it. They were making that movie for me. Make no mistake about it. And I really enjoyed it. I tend to like a slow-moving zombie movie a little bit more, though. I feel like when you take the quick-moving zombie movies and you compare them to the slow-moving zombie movies, it seems like most of the time the quick-moving zombie movies aren't saying a whole lot. You know, this movie is an exception for sure, as is 28 Days Later, which I think 28 Days Later started the quick-moving zombie.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Like, that was, like, not a thing. I mean, it inspired so much from, like, zombie movies to, like, Geoff Johns, which does, like, DC Comics, Green Lantern stuff. Like, when that movie came out, it blew up so many different areas. And I know it seems really weird talking about another movie about this movie, but there's no way that this movie or book comes out without this movie. If there's no Last of Us, there's no 28 Days Later, there's no Girl with All the Gifts. And I think it's an amalgamation of a lot of really good movies and games that it really does make a solid movie.
So you already listed 28 Days Later, so we won't hit that later. But I have a lot down for influences, because this movie draws from a lot of things. It reminds me of a Tarantino movie in a way. Like, Tarantino takes a lot of elements from movies that are kind of niche and then, like, just mixes them together and makes his own thing. And that's what this is. It's just pulling elements from other horror movies and putting it together. But I do think the sum of its parts are more than just its parts. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
Like, it equals a pretty good movie, I gotta say.
Absolutely.
Does it hit the pantheon of zombie movies? No, I'm not putting it up there.
It's a really solid movie that has solid influences,
yeah.
But it's not the best zombie movie I've ever seen.
And that's debatable anyway. Like, if you want to talk about my Mount Rushmore of zombie movies, it is 28 Days Later is on the Mount Rushmore. This is in no particular order. This is just the Mount Rushmore. Shaun of the Dead is in my Mount Rushmore,
because
it's hilarious, but it works as a zombie movie and it's actually saying something.
Which is not a thing, because it's like a lot of the comedy-based zombie movies I've seen are fucking horrible. With the exception of, like, Fido. That's a fucking really good one.
See, that was initially what I thought of when you said that.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, Fido was good. Shaun of the Dead is great. Like, to me, it's on the Mount Rushmore. I would put Night of the Living Dead on the Mount Rushmore, and none of the remakes, go fuck yourself with those remakes. The Romero one, the black and white one, it's talking about race. It's talking about race that made people very uncomfortable in the 60s. And I would say the original Dawn of the Dead is on there. Their zombies look like shit. I totally admit it, but there's really good content in there.
There's something to say, though. That's what's so devastating about that end when he makes it through. Everything's fine. And then they shoot him in the fucking face. And it's so fucking devastating because it's like, yep. Oh, yeah, that would happen.
It's a rednecky dude who's coming up to him and shoots him in the face. And he gets all this blowback by, like, kind of like a red meat conservative who he's holed up with the whole time. This white guy who's just used to things going his way. But it's all so fucking subtle. That's the thing. It's all so subtle. He never hits you over the head with it until the very end when he just smacks you in the face with a cinder block with it, where he's just like,
yep.
Hey, guess what? It was there the whole time. And now you got to think about it. Like, brilliant movie. And this is in that school. Does it get onto Mount Rushmore? No. Is it top 20? Probably.
Yeah, I think it's close. It's close to the mountain. It's looking up at the peak. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's right there. It didn't change anything for me about zombie movies, and it didn't really bring anything new. It just took from what was already there and made something good. And for me to be on the Mount Rushmore of zombie movies, you have to do something like Shaun of the Dead. You have to totally break the barrier of what a zombie movie is. And that's why, like, I think the last good zombie thing I've ever seen was probably the Walking Dead graphic novel. And beyond that, I mean, like, I've really been wanting to say this. I know I talked to you about it, Biggs, but my high from Zack Snyder is just gone now. So, you know, I keep seeing these fucking ads where it's like, well, this is what I was gonna do, but fucking Warner Brothers. And it's like, dude, I don't care now that you were gonna make a 303 or a fucking
303
Army of the Dead 2. You know what I mean? Like, I don't need that. I don't need you to make that movie. Like, it's like, okay, you remade one thing that was, like, pretty dope. But then again, it's like, re-talking to Bix about it, it's like, I think what really got me with that movie is, one, I love monologues. And that really is something that gets me. And that Joker monologue, big dick energy, bro. And that fucking sucked me in like a, I don't even fucking know.
I love how you turn this back into, like, talking about the Snyder Cut again.
I know. I'm sorry, but I just wanted to state it.
You even have literally two Zack Snyder zombie movies you could talk about. One, which is relevant right now, and you're like, let's go back to Justice League one more time.
And you know, that Zack Snyder movie, it's fun. It's a fun movie with Batista, but it's not good. And it's cheesy. Could have lived without seeing that movie, to be honest. Yeah.
I have been very, very played out on zombie movies, and it takes a lot for me to appreciate a zombie movie at this point. They oversaturated it in the last 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
Like, zombies were hitting very, very hard. Do you know? Okay, I want to talk about one more weird thing before we get into this. And I'm just going to throw down a prediction right now. When you look at the next 4 years, I'll say 5 years because it usually tends to happen after this happens. But when you look at the next 5 years, I think we're going to see a rise in vampire movies. So there's a sociological thing that when there's a Democrat in the White House, that monster movies that come out, most popular ones tend to involve vampires, which, like, psychologically, they are a stand-in for Republicans, right? Like, why is Count Dracula rich as fuck? Right? He feeds off of the masses, right? But then the zombie movies are a stand-in for Democrats. So it's just like this fear of this overwhelming, like, unwashed population coming over and taking over everything, and, like, different races coming and, like, changing everybody and turning them into the other.
I have heard of this before, and I love vampire movies, so I bring it. I would be down for them. I know they're supposed to be making Interview with a Vampire or remaking that, and I would be okay with that. I love that movie series. I hope they keep going on with the book series instead of just making, like, two, you know? That would be cool if they just made more. There's, like, 8 books in that series. He goes to Atlantis at one point, dude. Like,
I'll be honest, man. I was fucked out on vampires when I was a kid. In the 80s, there was so many vampire movies that I've just never really recovered. And it's also like the zombies for me. Like, it takes something really original before I like it. But I just haven't seen that with a vampire movie in a long time. I'm trying to think of the...
Dude, you got to watch The Strain.
When did that come out?
That's a TV series that ended, I think, in 2016, something like that. Top notch, bro. It Guillermo del Toro made this TV show, and it's fucking dope.
Okay, well, then it's got to be good.
Yeah, it started off as a book, and then he wanted to make it into a graphic novel, and then he ended up making it into a TV series.
Well, we should jump into this movie.
Yes, absolutely.
I have no history with it, if anybody wondered. I saw it yesterday, so... A girl is confined by the military and treated like garbage. They seem to fear her, but why? You're entering the void!
The children are imprisoned by a group of soldiers led by Sergeant Eddie Parks and go to school at an army base in the home counties. It's like the surrounding area of like London, where they are experimented on by Dr. Caroline Caldwell, which is Glenn Close. Right from the beginning, man, it is pretty heavy. You basically just see children shackled. You see this girl counting. She has a picture of a cat and some other bullshit up on her wall. They're fucking prisoners, you know.
It's very reminiscent of the Holocaust, the way that they set it up. Yeah,
they're fucking prisoners. The guards literally are, like, smacking on the gates and, like, wake up, you fucking abortions. Like, just... totally being brutal to these kids. You know, there's like probably 20 of them. They have to shackle themselves up. And then, you know, you see this little girl whose name is Melanie. And, you know, the moment that the soldiers come in to get them out, they're strapped into a wheelchair, like a mental patient. You know, one of the dudes has a gun pointed right in her face. And then there's a girl soldier that's like, all right, let's go. And Melanie is like, hello, how are you doing today?
Yeah, it's completely normal to her. This is just like her daily transactions is she talks to everybody in a sweet voice and is very nice. And they treat her like garbage.
Yeah, they're literally like, shut up, bitch, and like, you know, don't fucking talk to me, don't get close to it, watch your fucking space. Like, they're fucking like uptight with these kids. And then they wheelchair them into a classroom where we have Helen Giustini, which is their teacher, and she's kind of responsible for, like, you know, teaching them and whatnot. Then that's when we meet Melanie. And, you know, we find out that Helen is kind of fond of her and that they have this kind of bond. And, you know, they're talking about a book.
They're reading Greek mythology, right?
Yeah. They're explaining Pandora's box, which is like, now that we're in the spoiler zone, really later in the movie, they call back to this. And I honestly just put it together like a few minutes ago before we started this, the callback. But, they're explaining Pandora's box.
Epimetheus stole fire because his name from Latin translates to afterthought. So he stole it and just didn't think about it. Prometheus gave fire to people, but the gods were upset that they stole the fire. So to punish Epimetheus, and I'd say Epimetheus, it's actually Epimethe if you'd study Latin, which I did for 1 year in high school. They had him marry Pandora, and Pandora gets a box. They tell her not to open the box. And so when she's in there, she finally opens the box, which sets free all of the troubles in the world onto mankind. But then she looks deeper in the box and she finds one more thing, which is hope. Right. And that's the part that we always leave out of Pandora's box. Like, it's kind of interesting, our relationship to Greek mythology in America, because we will know these tales forwards and backwards, except for the end. We miss the lessons a lot.
Yeah.
And that's one of the lessons with Pandora is like, yes, she unleashed all of these things onto the world, but she also gave us hope, which they did not have before. And so the idea is that, like, with enough hope, you can come through tragedy, or at least be able to deal with it. And that's really that part of the myth, what they're talking about. But we always kind of like skip over that. This movie absolutely engages with that.
They really feed into that story. So like right after that scene, you know, the next day happens, same thing, you know, she's holding her breath and counting and then wakes up and then, you know, goes back to the room and the teacher had asked them to write stories. And she writes a story that, like, is basically she's Pandora and she's saving the teacher. And, you know, she wrote this beautiful story and, you know, it absolutely fucks up Helen because she's like, how can you treat these children like this? Like, this is a fucking person, you know? And then she goes up to pat her head. The guard comes in and is like, no fucking way. Get the fuck away.
And I think that's a direct quote too.
Yeah, it literally blasts and is like,
no fucking way.
Yeah. He's literally like, no fucking way, you fucking dumb bitch. Like, comes in and lathers his shit on his arm.
No, he spits on his hand.
Yeah, he spits on his hand. Oh, yeah, because they all have that stuff on.
We find out later they have this gel that takes away smell. But I assume because spit is from the inside of your body, you can't, like, lather that with gel. So he just spits onto his hand, and then all the kids are like, like, kind of making all this noise.
Yeah, it's brutal. And he's like, these things are fucking animals. You cannot ever break that mindset. It's kind of like, you know what it reminded me of? When I lived on a farm, my stepdad told me, never name them.
Yeah.
Never name the animals. And I didn't understand why. And he's like, I asked him why. And he's like, because the moment you name them, you become attached. And then the moment you have to use them for food or put them down or anything happens, you get emotional about it because you're like bonded with them. And I think that that's kind of what's going on here, you know.
You're right. But it's even further than that, because I don't think that they've ever looked at these kids as human beings. Anybody but the teacher, that is. We find out their origins, which is grisly, but they have always looked at them as the other. And they don't speak about them as their human beings either, right? Like they say, don't touch it. Don't look at it all the time. And they say horrible things to them. They treat them horribly. They confine them. You have like another teacher who steps in and teaches a lesson before our main teacher comes in. And she's just going through the motions and doesn't even really care what she's teaching them, because what's the point? They're not people as far as she's concerned.
The interesting thing I want to pinpoint about that, like you hit it right there. That is such a reflection of like reality.
Well, let's be real here. I really want to look at what they're saying with this movie, because this movie is clearly saying things that are subtext. It's not text, right? And the subtext of this, they're talking about racism. They're talking about how a lot of white teachers will treat minorities when they're in the classroom, right? Like they treat them like they're others, like they're not as good as the other students or not worthy. Like they're not even people in a way. And don't bother wasting your time, right? Like we see this kind of stuff all the time in society. And this movie is rife with talking about race. Like it is all over the place. Mm-hmm. You do not put a black girl in the center of a movie that's filled with nothing but white people, and you're not talking about race. I mean, that's just the reality of this. And it's all over this movie. And they're definitely talking about it right here. And there's going to be a key difference from the book, which we are going to talk about when we get to source materials, because I kind of disagree with something that they did in this movie. But we'll get to that when we get to that. That's just a little taste before the end.
A little taste. Fucking Scarface style. A little taste.
He didn't take a taste. He took a lot up in those nostrils.
Here. I know. He took it straight to the dome. They're noticing, Melanie notices that certain kids are disappearing. It's kind of asking the teacher why. You know, we see that people are visiting Melanie at night, basically. Probably not supposed to. The teacher shows up and, you know, Melanie freaks out and she's like, it's dope because she knows. She knows when she gets to that point where she's like, you need to go. Like, you need to leave. I'm going to fuck you up. Like, please go. And she dips. It's a horrible thing. She freaks out, leaves her little gel on the floor.
I think they call it like beta blockers or something. Not beta blockers, but they call it some kind of blockers.
Yeah. Glenn Close shows up and basically is probing her about, which I love this little bit, the Schrodinger's cat. She had asked her about the Schrodinger's cat and then is like, what is your, you know, what do you think? And, you know, Melanie's really smart. She's really poking and prodding, like, am I there? Can I open it? Can I poke a hole? And she's like, no, you just have to know.
We should go backwards into the setup of this. So the scientist is asking her, pick a number between 1 and 20. And she says 13. And then the next day she notices that the kid who is in 13 is gone, right? So she had her pick the kid. This kid who we're following is supposed to be a genius. Like, they've definitely laid out all the clues for that all over the place, right? And so the scientist is playing a little game with her to see if she catches on. And she asks her about Schrodinger's cat, basically, like, is it alive or is it dead? Can I open the box? Well, if you open the box, then it's going to be alive or dead. You need to figure it out before you open the box. And the answer is supposed to be it's alive and dead, right? Like, that's typically how you answer it. But she basically proposes this to the girl because she shows her, if she picks the number, that the kid will disappear. And then she gives her a riddle she knows the kid's going to want to try and get the answer to, because it's a very hard question. And so she's basically having the kid hang herself, because the scientist sucks. The scientist is very evil and not looking at them as people. She's looking at them as lab experiments.
I would say that she is so focused on doing what is best for humanity. It's like one of those things where it's like, kill one person to save thousands, you know?
I don't agree, because she's already dehumanized all of the people, and she's playing games by having her pick a number to see which one she's going to go at.
Yeah, that is kind of fucked up, actually. Never mind.
Yeah, like, she is no different than a Nazi scientist.
You think?
Yeah, because she's already dehumanized all of the people that she has to experiment on. Like, it's like your stepdad said with the animals, don't name them, right? Or you'll get attached to them. She's looking at them as subhuman, but she's looking at them as subhuman because she's going to fuck them up, but she's also taking a joy in fucking them up. You don't play a head game like that with the smart kid unless you're cruel. There's just no way around it. You blindly take them, you have them knocked out, you don't have a conversation with them or anything like that. If she was really trying to be humane but really felt like she had to do it, it was not the way that she handled it. Like, I think she is cruel, and I think she's an evil person. I'm just going to put that out there.
Yeah, no, that kind of doesn't make sense. So basically all that happens, she does choose her own number, and then she gets dragged out. And then this is the first scene where you see the entire base, and they're on a military base. And there are so many zombies that are overrunning one of the fences. And they're like, all right, everyone, we got to send everyone over to this fence right now. Like, we got to do this right now. There's a lot of gunfire going on. And then basically, you know, Glenn Close is about to put her down. You see the brain and all the fungi on the brain of, like, other people she's worked on, and puts her down and keeps giving her sedatives because she heals fast from the sedatives. So, like, you know, they're about to do this. Basically, they get an intercom call that, like, the base is overrun. So, and Glenn Close is like, I don't care. We're still doing this.
Yeah, shut the shutters, she says, because they have these metal shutters over the windows.
Yeah, and Helen shows up, immediately fucks up the phone, and is like, you can't do this. No, I will not let you do this. I will not let you fuck up Melanie. She's a person. And then that amount of time between her getting removed, and she gets fucking pepper sprayed point blank, which is fucking brutal. But she gets pepper sprayed by the Nazi bitch and gets removed. And that amount of time was too much time. The zombies break in through the window before the shutters go down, fuck up her, like, assistant. She turns, she cuts her hand, and then, you know, basically they're all leaving. The base is fucked. I mean, it goes chaotic at this point. The base is overrun by Hungries, and Melanie escapes, wandering outside where the soldiers are being violently attacked. Melanie and Helen board an escaping truck with Caldwell, which is the main army guy that's like, you know, don't go, don't, no fucking way, that guy. And two surviving soldiers, Gallagher and Dylan. Melanie is restrained by a muzzle to prevent her from biting others. Dylan is killed when Hungry's attack as the group... actually, I'll come back to that. They explain that the face mask is... they were using that to capture kids.
Yeah, they were going in to grab kids that they needed. And so they were putting them on them so that they wouldn't bite them and then dragging them back to where they needed to go.
Yeah.
Like, you kind of, they give you enough context clues to put it together. I don't think they out and out say it, but.
That's definitely what was going on. And, you know, so they're driving pretty far away. They're like probably the only people to survive. They're just outside of London. So they're trying to reach another base, but they're just out of like the signal for, you know, whatever. And they're stopping for water. Basically, Dylan gets attacked. Yeah, they just dip.
They don't let him back into the van because they do the whole... I mean, we've seen this in a million zombie movies, but...
Yeah.
You're bleeding on your arm, and he's like, it's not a bite, it's not a bite. And he's like, well, let's just wait. And then the guy starts doing the ha-ha-ha thing. And then, of course, he just shoots him in the head the second he does it. So, and you see that cold exterior go over the soldier, too. This woman that we're talking about who's so cold to the girl. Like, you see him, he was friends with that guy very clearly. And at the second that dude turns, it's just, like, cold. And it's like, he's not one of us, and just... pops him in the head, you know. He's dehumanized this guy who he was personally friends with as well.
And they were about to pop Melanie too, right when they got her in the vehicle and Caldwell realized that she was there. And Glenn Close was like, no, we need her. We need, like, this is like probably the only cure. Any bit of ounce of cure that we could get, you know, would be from this person. The group reaches London by foot and makes their way through a swarm of dormant Hungries using a blocker that masks their scent, rendering them largely invisible because they only see via sight and smell and hearing, but they hibernate when they're not doing anything, so they just like basically stand still.
They basically go into rest mode.
Yeah, they go into rest mode. And so they're like literally walking through like thousands of them to get to like a spot. And
yeah, they explain that the only thing that really snaps them out of it is a sudden loud noise or smell, right? Like if they smell people. So that's why they have that gel on.
Right. They basically stumble upon a female zombie that's been walking around with a baby stroller, which Glenn Close's character, like, is fucking with it. I don't understand why she did that.
She wanted to look inside it and see what it was because she's never seen maternal instincts in one of the Hungries before. So she wanted to study it. What the fuck was in there? I saw like a glimpse.
It was a rat eating a baby. Maybe the baby was already dead. I don't know what happened, but it was a rat eating a baby. And basically that spooked the other ones. And then now they're kind of running and silently shooting zombies or Hungries to get to this hospital where they kind of chill for the night. And this is where Caldwell reveals the dark secret that second generation Hungries were discovered after babies killed their infected mothers by burrowing out of the womb.
Can I tell you something that kind of upsets me?
Yeah.
There was a while where I was toying with writing a zombie thing back when that was way more popular. And the first thing I came up with was having zombies in a prison. And it was going to be a metaphor for terrorism. Because they were going to like put prisoners into prisons and then like they would eventually stick them in there with the zombie, but it was all about the fear of the zombies. I was going to tie it in with terrorism. It was a little bit after 9/11 when I started to write this. And then I fucking saw two or three zombie movies that were set in prison. I was like, motherfucker. So then the next great idea I had was like, what fucking happens if like a kid goes stillborn? And like the zombie apocalypse, like, would it just eat the way out of the mother? And so I had that idea and I was trying to like work on it and it was still in the back of my head.
Boom.
And then I saw this and I was like, motherfucker, dude, because I had that idea like 4 years before this movie and I should have fucking done something about it, but whatever.
Right.
I could have made a movie that lost $1 million at the box office.
Dude, you could be Zack Snyder right now. You can literally be Zack Snyder right now.
Yeah, what's the difference between me and Zack Snyder? Probably like 100 pounds soaking wet, right? He's a wee little guy.
I know. Sure, wee little lad. In the morning, the group realizes that they have been surrounded by Hungries. Melanie is a second generation Hungry, is ignored by the Hungries. So they basically propose that she needs to dip to go find a cat to fucking like.
No. She tells them, you should let me go and I'll find something to distract them.
No, because they brought up the cat thing, because that's what Gallagher.
They said, we got to wait till a cat comes by. The asshole to this point, he basically says, yeah, it could be days before a cat comes out. And then the little girl suggests, let me go out. And none of them trust her. She's basically like, you're going to die anyway. Like, if I don't go, I promise you I won't. I don't want to go. So,
yeah. And then she explains that, like, she loves Helen and that she would never attack Helen. And Helen knows that to be, like, truth. You know, they let her do that. They give her a walkie-talkie, send her on her way. She's, like, literally fucking with the walkie-talkie. She's like, hello, hello, Melanie.
That's a little bit later, right? Like, first she goes out and goes out of the hospital, finds a cat. Like, she eats a cat first. Then she finds a little dog. And then she brings the dog out and the dog goes to... And I'm watching. I'm like, what the fuck? Because she's carrying the dog by the zombies. And I'm like, oh, that's what she's doing. Because the dog runs off and they all chase the dog. Mm-hmm. Then they go to another part and she suggests going to clear out a road. To like, or to find a clear path. And so that's when the guy trusts her and gives her the radio, right? And so she's like playing with it with him. But that's the first time you see him start to slip and start to feel like she's kind of a human being, right? Like that's when we see him slip on it. Because we see a real turn with him. By the end of the movie, he is completely turned and he's clearly looking at her as a little girl rather than an other. This is the first step in that, I think.
You know, her helping really allows her to establish her value to the group as, you know, like, she just establishes that she can be of use. And, you know, they start treating her as a human. We catch Melanie reading a story to Gallagher, and that's when they click. Everyone's starting to come close with her, you know, and that's the fucked up thing, too, is that, like, you know, she is starting to get close to people.
There's a shitty thing going on in here, too. When they're talking about the race comparison, I think they're making a parallel to saying things like, well, like, black people are useless, except for they can go out and pick cotton for us, or they can go out and do this stuff. Like, I think they're doing a comparison to slavery here. Mm-hmm. This person is allowed to go over to the other camp because we know that he'll come back, right? So he's of use to us. And I think they're drawing that comparison there with her. She's still basically enslaved as far as they're concerned. But at that point, they feel like they've conditioned her so much that she will come back. At first, it was out of necessity, but now they just feel that way. And you do see the turn in that one guy, but that's still under the surface, right?
As they progress through London, they come across piles of infected bodies encircling the BT Tower, which has been overgrown by a massive fungal growth. Caldwell explains that the growth contains seed pods, which if released, could release airborne spores that would end mankind. They take shelter in an abandoned mobile laboratory that was sent into the city earlier by military authorities. This thing is huge. I mean, it's literally a tower covered in fungal spores. And
it's fucked up. It's all these bodies on the bottom with all these vines coming out of their head, basically. And then these giant seed things on top. And I think, doesn't the scientist tell her around now that, like, those seeds won't open? Like, she goes to, like, throw it down. Because she says, like, it would end life if they opened. But then she throws it down and it won't pop open. It's too tough of an exterior to crack open. But I think she eventually reveals to the girl that if there's a flood or a fire that runs through, that would be the end of humanity right there. Like, it would spread the seeds and they'd go airborne. And so you wouldn't be able to breathe.
Yeah, because it would be airborne. And then they would just hit everyone and it would just spread. We realize that Caldwell is injured from the leaving the base and is dying of sepsis. She reasons that she could save the human race by sacrificing Melanie to complete her vaccine research in the lab. As the group runs out of food, Gallagher proposes that he ventures off into the city on a supply run. Gallagher basically gets fucking tricked into a market, which is fucked up. Basically, there are feral children that have been running around that are in the same spot as Malini. They're second generation Hungries, and they're basically a tribe, and they trick him into going into this place by leaving cans out, and then he gets ambushed and just eaten to nothing, and it's super fucked up. Melanie smells this. She has a keen sense of smell. So she tells them they're looking for him. They come too late.
And they're saying he's got the blocker on. And she says, well, the blocker has a smell too. If you can identify the smell of a blocker, then you know that there's people around, which is smart. That makes sense.
Yeah, that does make sense. And they basically show up to where they were at, find the body. She realizes that Gallagher was tricked, then realizes, oh, fuck, this is also a trap. She gets into a 1v1 battle with the leader of the fucking tribe and beats him to death with a bat. Yeah. I'll be honest, up until this point, that's the only cheesy scene for me, is her screaming.
Yeah.
With her pretending to be like one of the Hungries. That's the only cheesy thing for me.
But she is one of the Hungries. That's the irony.
I know, but it's like her pretending to have that growl was just like, ugh. I didn't need that.
The first thing that takes me out of the movie is when they call them Hungries. I'm like, I'm not super on board with just not calling it a zombie. But then it's another thing to be like, Hungries? Really? Like, you know, like Walking Dead calls them walkers. And I'm like, at least that makes sense. Like, I don't hate the term walkers.
That's cheesy too, though. I prefer infected.
Sure.
I think that seems more legit. So they kill the leader. She freaks out the children, allowing them to escape. And then she tells them, and I love this scene too. I love hate this scene because I love how she's like, all right, just act like you're afraid of me. And they're like, fucking Caldwell's like, act. Because he's like genuinely fucking afraid.
Yeah.
And they go back. Parks realizes that Caldwell left open the door. And he's like, what the fuck? And goes in. She has somehow put something that knocked them all out that's airborne.
She released gas into it because she's wearing like a gas mask. And so when they come in, they go to shut the door and then they all pass out because there's gas in there. And she takes off a gas mask after a minute and starts to go to work on the girl, right? Mm-hmm.
And she like pretty much immediately wakes up.
And we should also say that the scientist at this point, Caldwell, has blood poisoning. She's revealed this earlier. And so she knows she's going to die. So I guess for her legacy, she's trying to make this vaccine at this point.
That's the thing that's hard for me, to put her as a completely evil person. Because even though she is doing something that's fucked up, she is genuinely trying to make a vaccine to save humanity. But then there's also this argument within this movie that it's like, are people really worth saving?
Yeah, and we'll get back to that when we get there. But two things. First off, the vaccine is pointless to me because the Hungries are gonna fucking eat everybody eventually anyway.
Yeah, but it's like if those pods go off, at least people don't turn. That's the only thing.
I don't know. I feel like it's running in place in a way. There's not enough people to even do it. Like, we never see people wandering around ever in this movie. You know what I mean? It's just them. Like, it's so desolate at this point.
They do get in contact with the other base when they get to that base.
Right, because the base is getting overrun.
Yeah, and their base is getting fucking overrun, too.
They're fucked, dude. They might be the last couple of people on Earth, honestly. Like, we just don't know. And, like, let's say you make that vaccine. What are you going to fucking do with it after that? You know what I mean? Like, okay, so you have a vaccine and you got these two living people. How are they going to distribute it? Like, how many doses is one kid going to make? You know what I mean? Like, you need raw material for that.
True. I guess I didn't put that far of a thought into it. I just thought, oh, cure. Oh, we have a cure.
But I don't think it's a flaw in the movie. I think they're showing what a fucking like nutcase this lady is, and she's dying of blood poisoning on top of it, so she's not on top of her game anyway. Like, she's not thinking scientifically anymore. But they're just, I don't like her. I'm not gonna like her towards the end either. And I think it's the fact that Glenn Close does enough with it to where it makes you think twice about it, because she's that good of an actress, to be honest.
Yeah,
Like, I think she makes the character a little more charismatic than people normally would. I think people would normally play that way over the top, and Glenn Close plays it. It's all underneath. You know what I mean? Which makes it worse.
Dude, I'm telling you, it's the Cruella de Vil vibe that Glenn Close brings to this movie that is so, yeah. Anyways, Caldwell is attempting to dissect her as the group returns. She's imploring Melanie to sacrifice herself because she pretty much immediately wakes up.
And her hand's fucked up now too, so she can't even operate on her. That's the thing. You look at her hand and it's all fucked up. She realizes it, like...
And she's screaming in pain, yeah.
Is a kid gonna fucking cut her own head open? So, like, you're fucked, dude. You can't do this.
Melanie comes to the realization that she is not an experiment and that her kind, human-zombie hybrids, will be the future of the world. She escapes... And Glenn Close is trying to basically, like, stop her. She's all fucked up. She gets fucking surrounded by the zombie feral kids and just gets murdered. Melanie sets the seeds on fire. It releases the pods. Parks leaves to go find her. Basically is like, what did you do? And then he starts turning. And then he basically is like, please don't let me become one of them. Gives her a gun. Melanie shoots him in the face, basically, as he's turning. And she shuts the door for just for what's-her-face, Helen. And basically, Helen wakes up and sees all the spores. Melanie's there. And basically, it cuts forward to, I would assume, a little bit later. I don't know how much I like this part because I think it's kind of flawed. So the film ends with Justine waking up, being crying, Helen waking up, crying, basically safe, but like she's confined in this lab due to the environment. She wakes up and she's basically teaching all the kids, and Melanie's like her assistant teacher, basically. And it's like basically like the first scene in the movie with Helen teaching the kids.
She's the one that's enslaved, not them.
Yeah. Which is such an interesting like flip. I guess I actually do like that. I don't like the thought of, oh, they get a week of this because how is she going to get food?
So there's an airlock, there's a door, and then another door.
How does she clean the food? How does she, you know, because she's going to have to, like...
You don't have to. It's airborne. It's not something that you touch.
One of the spores attached to anything, and then, you know, once you bring that in, it would, like, have little,
I think you're fine. I think you just set it in the airlock, and you wait a little bit, as long as it takes to die out, because there's no oxygen if it's a spore.
Yeah, but spores can travel through space, right? So they can live without oxygen. So, like, in theory, like, anything, everything would be fucked, dude.
These spores, as far as we know, the only way that they are deadly at the beginning is if somebody has it within them and then they bite somebody and they deliver it through their blood system, right? It's through a bite or whatever it goes. So then it goes airborne, which means you breathe it in. But the truth is, if you stick something in an airlock and you just open it up and wash your hands and wash the can, then like it's fine. This is like the super duper paranoid people at the beginning of the pandemic that would buy boxes of groceries and fucking wash their boxes. I'm sorry. I know everybody is freaking out. I'm sure there's some people listening who did that and feel embarrassed about it or think I'm a dumbass for not. But like... I've been working adjacent to medical fields for a long time, taking care of people. This is just germophobia. Like, it's just fucking damn germophobia. And like, nobody wants to take any chances and they worry about it way heavier. Like, what you gonna do? Starve to death? Like,
I guess.
Clearly, right? They worked something out, you know? Anyway, but what I don't like about this scene.
Oh, there's more things to not like about this scene?
Yeah. So we're going to bring forward the source material to talk about this. Because in the book, the main girl is white and the teacher is black. Okay?
Oh.
And so at the end of this, after the white girl decides that she's going to kind of take over the world, now it's her time and they're taking over everything and that decision is made, she's basically enslaved the black woman. I think that that makes a lot of sense from that book because like they're basically pointing something at society and saying, this is a real problem. This is something that we do. You get these white people who feel like victims and then they like corner minorities and put them in bad positions.
There's a big thing in America where slavery ended a long time ago, but everywhere else in the world, slavery did not really end for quite a while. Like,
it's still here.
Yeah, like England, or not England, Africa, which is like pretty much very England adjacent in a way. They ended what, slavery in the 80s? Or something like that, right?
You're talking about like South Africa with apartheid and shit like that.
Yeah. So I feel like this movie really reflects on that versus like our culture where, you know, slavery is like very still a recent thing.
But it's also not written by a British person. It's written by an American. It's just a British film. But here's the thing I'm trying to say is like in the book, when you do that, it's mirroring something in society, so it makes sense. When you flip the races like they do in this movie, now you're essentially putting out the message, whether they intend to or not, that if black people are suddenly free, that they're going to flip around and enslave the white people. Like, it's a bad fucking look.
I don't like that at all, because I did not take that as the ending.
I read a lot of think pieces on this because there wasn't a whole lot available. So what I took, I read up on and I really thought about it, you know?
What I got from this movie is I didn't really get the slavery thing. Now that we're talking about it, I get it now. But in my mind, it was more about letting the old die and the new survive, you know?
Yes. That is another thing. There's a couple of themes that run through this, but I wanted to talk about the race theme as we went along.
Yeah, that is a very big part of it. And reflecting this movie over, I do get that now. But I think I like a world where the book is different kind of and the movie's different kind of. I do like that.
The problem is that like the way in which it's different, it really fucks up the message when you flip that. You know what I mean?
Why can't both things have different messages though and be as of the same vein? You know what I mean?
Because they're basically the same thing, but they flip the races, which... like it has an impact on this particular thing. It really does. It changes the perception of the message. Like if you're trying to like put subtext out there, you can't fucking muddy it. That's kind of my point. Mm-hmm. And maybe they were just afraid to deliver it that way. And so they flipped it. I don't know what their intention was, but I can tell you what it looks like when I watch it. If you're looking at it from a subtextual level. And when you read about the book, that's when it's just like, what the fuck? We are in a section of time where we're really conscious of this stuff and thinking about this stuff. And so you got to really think about the messages you're putting out there. So to me, that's a black eye on the message they were trying to set up with this film. You are right about the old generation kind of passing and the new generation taking over. That's absolutely in this movie. I have that down for themes. Sometimes the younger generation has to take the torch. This particular movie, they have a literal torch that she takes, right? Like the older generation is not handing the torch. She's got to take it. That often happens in history. Sometimes you just have to pop them in the face and say, I'm in charge now, old man. Then hope a boomer doesn't come in a police uniform.
I will quote the great Dewey from Malcolm in the Middle. It's my time, old man. I love that scene when they're playing basketball with the dad. And then the dad realizes that he's like old now and he like hurts himself. And he's like, this is our time. They like trip him.
He puts ricin in the kids like stevia. Because it's Bryan Cranston. Shouldn't have fucked with him, dude. Right.
Oh, man. That should be a movie we cover is El Camino
at some point. I would totally do that. Absolutely. So for effects, they had drones that flew over the Ukrainian town of Pripyat to give the appearance of an abandoned London. Pripyat was abandoned because it was irradiated after the Chernobyl meltdown. So there's been a few horror movies that have done that. Whenever you need like empty streets in Europe, it's a good place because nobody's there and it's still irradiated. Like people can walk around for a little bit without dying, but you can't like stay there or you will fucking die of radiation poisoning.
Yeah. And just to bring it back to 28 Days Later, the fact that they were able to do the opening few scenes without anybody there is fucking wild, because they went to very busy parts of England or London, and I mean, they were able to clear the streets. That's like going to, you know, New York and the middle part and like being like, all right, everyone, leave. You know what I mean? Like
they did that one time. Did you ever see Vanilla Sky?
No.
All right, it's not a great movie. there's a part in it where they're in Times Square and it's completely empty. And that was not CGI. They actually like managed, they had a permit to empty it for like 12 minutes. So they had everything blocked off and got their scene as quick as they could. And then
that's what they did with 28 Days Later. It's 15 minutes, I think.
Yeah, it makes a difference when you have a company that's making it with a lot of money. So that's what that'll get you. I have no movie behind the movie. There's very little information on this movie. The most I could find is that the British Film Institute put up $5 million for this, and that's more than they've ever put up for a movie before. But that's not much of a story. I just couldn't find anything about this movie. So what are the rules?
Oh, God. How do I say this sensitively? Don't trust children.
Liberally apply your KY jelly.
Yeah, liberally apply your KY jelly on your arms. Don't trust people that look like Cruella DeVille.
But what if she looks like Emma Stone?
Oh, damn. That is a thing now. Okay, don't trust Emma Stone either.
Not only is she Cruella, she's definitely somebody you want help from in the zombie apocalypse. So now I'm all confused.
Right.
Don't make loud noises. Apparently, don't teach Greek mythology, I guess.
Don't look at pornos, because you'll be like Gallagher and die. That scene when it's just like, you see him just munching out, and then he's looking at porno mags, and he's like, oh, yes. And then it's like, dude, they're baiting you so hard. Like, oh, God.
You got to admit, dude, if you're in that guy's place, you snag a mag. You know what I mean?
You snag. But he's just like trying to run out of there. He's like, oh. He's got all this, like, porno just stuffed into every fucking crevice.
I mean, yeah, I would grab one. I wouldn't go crazy. Like, you don't want to make noises. So you don't want them to hear, like...
Where are you going to jerk off? You're in a closed space.
Is the title of the movie said in the movie?
No.
No, I don't think so.
I don't think so.
Not any of the five titles I saw for this movie are said.
What other titles did you see?
I don't know, two or three. It looks like they changed the name. Maybe because it didn't sell.
Yeah, She Who Brings Gifts was one.
Does the story continue?
Okay, if the stories didn't continue, Melanie eats the last cat and then they all starve and die.
I think the teacher finally like freaks out and goes to make a break and then becomes a hungry.
Yeah, she dies regardless.
But you have a whole new generation. Like, that's a whole new movie if it made money, but it didn't, so...
I don't think that would be a good movie, though, because it would just be the few kids that can talk to each other, and then kids just...
I'd say it'd be good. I'd just say the story continues a little bit after this. We have a whole generation of kids growing up to be teenagers who then have spores plant out of their heads, I guess. I feel like that's the end game.
Is it just England? Is it because England's an island, you know? Are they just infected?
I think anytime you see something like this, it's the world, you know?
No, not true, because 28 Days Later was just England.
It started in England. Did you not see 28 Weeks Later? It spreads well beyond.
Yeah, but no. After. At the end, it does. But it is only just in... Because that's something the soldiers state is that they, like, walled England, and it's just in England.
Right, but it spreads at the end. That's my point. It always spreads, so it doesn't matter. And plus, didn't it come from, like, Africa or something? Didn't they say it was, like, some kind of seed things for that they... I don't know. Doesn't matter.
I don't remember.
Does it end at the right moment?
I would be down with not having the last scene. I would be down if it ends, like, right when she lights everything on fire.
I think the way that they handled the ending, as I talked about, I would rather not see it. Okay, so the reception, it made $4 million off of a $5 million budget, so that's not great. Helen O'Hara of Empire Magazine said, the best zombie-ish apocalypse in years. Sena Nanu, I don't know if I'm saying her name right, is a major discovery, but it's dense social commentary and moral dilemmas. And then Robert Abel of the LA Times said, as it lopes towards its ending, it's still undistinguished by any remarkable direction or performance, save Close's late bid for Mad Doctor Zest. One is left feeling that The Girl with All the Gifts is no better or worse than a couple of solid episodes of a sci-fi series, professionally engrossing, but unlikely to prompt your own feeding reflexes for more zombie fare. I liked it more than he did.
Like, I like looking at some reviews just quickly. 86%, 7.1 out of 10. That's right where I feel about it, where it's a good movie. It's definitely on the higher end of a good zombie movie, but it's not world changing at all.
But if you're talking about it as a B, I agree. It's a solid B movie. Not budget, but like, you know, grade.
Borderline B plus. I mean, it's right there.
It's a little tweak away from being a B plus, I think. Influences, we already did a couple. I don't think we have to go back over those. Also, I Am Legend. Have you ever read the book, not the movie?
Oh, I know it's more about vampires than it is about zombies.
Yes, it is. So the original book, it makes me mad because they've made this into a movie three different times. They did a Vincent Price version.
What? I didn't know that.
They did a Charlton Heston version called The Omega Man, and then they made the Will Smith version. They have never, ever, ever done the ending like it is in the book, and that's a fucking travesty because the ending of the book is amazing. So here's how it ends. This guy is killing all the vampires, and at a certain point, he realizes the vampires are intelligent. Like, he falls in love with this woman, and it turns out she is working with the vampires, and she is, like, an evolved vampire. And so she was going to betray him to bring him there. She feels bad about it, so she sneaks into his prison and brings him a cyanide capsule. And he finds out that everybody is afraid of him. He is the monster. The world has moved on without him, and he's the monster in the shadows that everybody's afraid of. So his last words are, "I am legend," and he takes a cyanide pill to kill himself. He has become the thing that is afraid. Why the fuck they never have this in any of the movies, I don't know.
That is such a fucking mind. You can't do that. You can't do that.
You could movie. Easily, if you watch the Will Smith one, they are leading up to that up until the end. When they get to the end, they take the rug out from under you and they don't do it. But watch it again, knowing that I just told you that end and know that they're working towards that. And then for some reason, they just change it at the end. It doesn't make sense with what they're laying out there. So I implore you to rewatch that, because I watched that movie having loved that book and was so fucking pissed off when I walked out of there.
Wow, that's so wild. I loved that movie. I just did not know that's how it ends in the book.
Yeah, I recommend reading the book. It's not a big read. It's kind of a novella.
Wow.
It's written by Richard Matheson.
Yeah, it came out in 1954. I didn't know that.
That's basically what this movie is talking about, right? Like, the humans are now the monsters of this world. Like, they're trying to kill everybody in this world to try and keep their way of life. And their way of life is old and it's past. And they are now the monsters because they're the ones mowing down everybody, right? Day of the Dead. Okay, this is the, I want to say, third Romero zombie movie. I think it's the third. It's set on a military base where the zombies are trying to come in. It looks exactly like it does in this movie. Plus the idea that humanity has evolved, but the zombies are not, when that's not necessarily true. The kids who are zombies are actually evolved. They've moved beyond humans, but they don't look at it that way. They look at them as the problem.
Well, they're afraid. They're afraid because they're dying out. And, like, I mean, these kids can breathe without needing oxygen, you know, because of the spores. And, like, they are evolved.
Invasions of the Body Snatchers. The idea that spores infecting a mind and changing their personalities. Way before your video game, dude. Way before your video game. So not the original 50s version, but the 70s version that has Leonard Nimoy. That one, it's all about spores. And so they've, like, put spores into that whole mythos, and it's a lot like that. So I think they're definitely pulling from that movie. And then the movie Monsters, which was made by Gareth Edwards, who is probably most famous for doing Rogue One and Godzilla.
Monsters. Is that which Monsters?
It's just called Monsters. It's this independent movie. He's going across South America and he's taking pictures of things. And basically, the director has said that he used this movie as a touch point for his entire movie. And he talked with Gareth Edwards before filming it. Essentially, what he pulled from it is the way that humanity is found in monsters and monstrosity in humans, right? Like, it's more subtle in Monsters, but I think it's more overt in this, right? Like, you look at the how everybody treats the zombies and that they treat them fucking terribly, right? They even name them Hungries, which is a terrible name to call somebody. At least they didn't call them the Hangries.
Right.
That makes a little more sense, though, right? The Hangries?
Yeah, the Hangries. Yeah. Yeah.
All right, that was a dad joke. I apologize. I could tell by your laughter.
I already said mine earlier.
Okay, what it influenced? I don't think it's influenced anything. Nah. I mean, it's been 5 years. Might be too soon, but I just don't think people have seen this movie.
Yeah. One thing I do want to bring up, that soundtrack was fucking amazing, dude. I was pretty blown away by the soundtrack. It's very hit or miss for me with movies, but like I would say this is like Ex Machina level soundtrack where I was very into the soundtrack.
Yeah. If we ever put this up on YouTube someday, you will see a synthesizer behind me. I could do that entire soundtrack so fucking easily. Dope. It is the most simple thing, but that doesn't mean it's not effective. Right. But all they're doing is holding down a note, and then they have a little pitch wheel that makes it go up and down. You hear it in like gangster rap all the time when they're like, doo, 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 doo,
doo, doo, doo, doo. Yeah, I know what you're talking about.
Right. They're just doing it with the pitch wheel. That's all they're doing throughout this. It's very, very simple.
It works but very
it is
good.
Effective.
It works very good.
It makes
good.
You feel uneasy, and it's got like this kind of hopeful quality at times. And then when it starts to bend, you're like, what's going on? It definitely works for this film. Other source material. So we talked about the book and the difference with the ending. There's another difference in it, which is they have junkers in the book, which are all of humanity that's left, that's not on the bases, are in these giant groups of people who have basically gone feral and they raid everything. And apparently they're just as dangerous as the zombies. I'm guessing they pulled that from Walking Dead. Pretty key thing. The Boy on the Bridge, which is a prequel book that's about a group of soldiers looking for a cure before the events of the film unfold. And then, of course, we talked about Greek mythology with Pandora. Would you buy this on 4K?
Oh, yeah. I absolutely would.
I did not sell this Blu-ray to settle medical debt because, as I said before, I had never fucking heard of this movie until yesterday. I'm not even sure it's on Blu-ray, dude.
Right. I don't think it is.
I know it's on HBO Max. I can tell you that.
Would you buy an HBO Max subscription to watch this movie? Yes.
No. I mean, like, as if you were like, hey, this movie's in it, and Last Week Tonight with John Oliver, I'm like, sure. Right. That's a British thing that I would definitely pay $15 a month for. A Cosmic Void was created and hosted by Jeremiah Perez and Alex Small. It's produced by Alex Small. Follow the show on Facebook at facebook.com/notsafefornetwork or on Instagram at @cosmic_void. You can follow my Letterboxd account under Alex Big Small. You can follow me on Instagram at @NSF_network as well as Jeremiah at @VexTillDeath. And join us next week when we'll be talking about Menace to Society. Subscribe to all the podcasts on our network. Season 3 of Movies with Wrestlers has Eric and Connor answering the question on everyone's mind, who's better, The Rock or John Cena? Every week, A Cosmic Void has Jeremiah and Biggs deconstructing influential movies. Not Safe for Network examines the zeitgeist through rabbit holes, deep dives, interviews, and pop culture battles weekly. And if you need some classic TV talk, catch up on the previous 3 seasons of In Syndication.